We spend a lot of time developing technology, but not talking with farmers. Yeah. So product development is an exercise of empathy. It's about being in the shoes of the customer.
Welcome to Leading the Shift, a podcast from Microsoft Azure, where we hear from the people at the forefront of data, AI, and cloud technologies. I'm your host, Susan Ettlinger.
Thanks so much for listening over the past several months. We've really appreciated it. And please keep letting us know what you think. Today, we're going to talk about water and specifically the intersection between water and technology. So let me just set a little bit of context. 60% of the human body is made up of water. About 70% of the Earth's surface is covered in water. And of that 70%, 96.5% is oceans, salt water. And so that little remaining extra bit, that is what we use for everything else. That's the fresh water, okay? So, and 70% of that is used for agriculture, 20% for industrial use, and the remaining 10% is how we brush our teeth and take our showers and make our food and all the things that we do. So, really, really interesting and important conversation. And the, you know, incredible innovation in data, AI, and cloud technologies is really helping us better understand how we use our water and recommend ways to help us use it more effectively. So today, we're going to talk about Argentina. And we're going to talk about farmers and agriculture in Argentina. And if you don't know, Argentina and many other countries in South America and, you know, in other places around the world have been undergoing severe, severe drought. And so there's a company called Quilimo, founded by Jairo Trod, who is our guest today, and they are helping farmers become better stewards of their water, optimize their water production or their water use, and essentially balance that beautiful connection between crop production and taking care of our water supply. So anyway, it's going to be a great conversation. Jairo, welcome to Leading the Shift.
Hi, Susan. Very happy to be here with you, sharing our story and sharing how we're leading the ship. Yeah.
That's amazing. So one of the unique opportunities I think we have in the current moment is to look at how technology can help us better solve some of humanity's greatest challenges, things that we didn't have the data or algorithms or AI to solve in the past. And you know, this is a life or death issue, obviously. But the second is that this also seems to be kind of a perfect application of data. And so can you talk a little bit about how you view this opportunity?
Yes. So when we started Quilimo, we had the sense that there was a big opportunity in solving a hard problem in agriculture. The hard problem is how farmers use water. Yeah. The initial and typical approach to that problem was, let's put a sensor on the farm. Yeah, let's put a device in the middle of a farm and measure things and be more efficient by measuring directly. Yeah, that's awesome. The problem is that also means that you have to leave a small device in the middle of nowhere. If it breaks, you have to go and maintain it. So the IoT approach was a hard approach to implement at scale. But we early on understood that there was a great shift in the availability of satellite data. Yeah, launching satellites to the space has been getting cheaper and cheaper and cheaper, but orders of magnitude. And by leveraging that new data, we were able to develop a tool that provides irrigation advice to farmers only using data, a combination of satellite data and weather data. And that tool combines also AI to provide clear advice to farmers. You have to irrigate half an inch in the next week. And that has opened for us a huge opportunity around the globe to help farmers be more efficient.
Clearly, it took a lot to get you to that point. And so I'm curious to hear a little bit, first of all, about your own journey, and then also sort of how you founded Quilimo, you know, how the company came to be and all of that.
Yes, sure. So I'm originally from the countryside of Cordoba in a valley that's called Tras la Sierra Valley. I was born and raised in a small town called Lujaba. It's a 700 people town. So starting there, I have as a valley, it was a very dry area. It rains very little there. So I always had a connection with agriculture, with the drought, and the fact that water is everything. Yeah, but that didn't click it deeply with me. So I ended up studying computer engineering. Don't ask me why, because at some point in my life, I got in love with computers and technology, and I understood that technology was like a superpower to change things. So I decided to study computer engineering. But as I was wrapping up my university journey, I saw an opportunity to start a company and a startup in the agriculture space. Again, no reason in particular, just because I understood that agriculture was hard and complex. And somehow I ended up approaching the problem of the intersection between water and agriculture. And that's where when everything fit together. So I started one company. We ended up closing that company because we failed. And that was very good too for us to learn many, many things that we didn't have as a background from university. And then...
So actually, give me an example. Like what things did you learn that you are applying now?
Wow. So first, one of the main learnings was that we spend a lot of time developing technology. But not talking with farmers. Yeah. So in the end, product development in general is an exercise of empathy. Yeah. It's about being in the shoes of the other person, of the customer. Yeah. The problem is that farmers are a very distant type of customer. Yeah. So when you see every successful technology, you're going to see that the demographic of that technology, in at least the initial demographic, was a very homogeneous demographic. So everybody was sort of the same. Yeah, farmers are all different. Agriculture is, if you move 100 kilometers north, agriculture is different than agriculture 100 kilometers south. So that in the first company, we didn't spend enough time talking with farmers. So in Quilimo, we spent the first 6 months doing nothing but talking with farmers. Yeah. And then we came back to the office, and then we spent some time doing actual coding, developing the first version of the tool. And somehow, 8 years later, that tool is still live and farmers are using it. And it's very, very similar to the initial development we did, with a lot more technology on the back end, but very similar because we took the time to understand how unique and different are the needs of these customers that we weren't able to connect with the first company.
Yeah, it's so interesting that you say that, because this theme is coming up over and over in the conversations that we're having. And frankly, whether they're social impact related or human impact related, or whether they're commercially focused, right? And so we've seen this in financial services. We've seen this in, you know, healthcare in rural communities around the world in the global south, that need to sort of really get close to the customer. And one of the people I interviewed early on, Perry Hewitt from data.org, had said that earlier in her career, like you, she had sort of underestimated the importance of trust and proximity in building, in co-creating sort of socio-technical tools for customers, whoever those customers or patients or consumers or, you know, citizens might be. So it's really interesting that you say that. I'm curious, like, how, what was that process like of sort of getting to know the farmers, building trust with them, and sort of envisioning these projects?
That process was a long one because it took us several months. Second, we didn't have a deep connection with industrial agriculture in Argentina. We didn't have neither family or friends in the space. So it was a game of just attending events of the topic and trying to meet a friend of a friend. The good thing about Argentina and many Latin American countries is that agriculture is a huge chunk of the GDP. So it's everywhere. Every time you scratch a little bit, you find somebody who is connected to agriculture. So we were able to find the farmers, but it took us a while to just keep asking until we found them. We have the exact number. We ended up in the track of my co-founder, we ended up traveling over 50,000 kilometers around Argentina, going to the events and things over those first 6 months, just to meet people. Yeah. But it was great, and was the only tool that enabled us to build a product that was needed and was clear for the farmer. Yeah, even when at the same time we were developing the product, the technology was just being developed. So we were doing this in 2014, 2015, and the satellites we're using right now were launched on 2015, 2016. So we were sort of At the same time the technology was being developed, the backend technology we need, we were doing this slow and very thorough product development part of the business that is more than half of the problem, of course. And
so how did they initially respond to this idea of putting sensors on their farms, or, you know, even the idea of sort of data collection at all?
Well, what you see is that agriculture is plagued by another big problem, that is loneliness. Yeah, there is in the U.S., for example, there is a high rate of suicide between farmers. Yeah, it's a lonely profession. You are alone in the middle of nowhere. And this is not a figurative nowhere. This is a literal nowhere. In the middle of the nearest town is sometimes 30, 50 kilometers. Yeah, so you're away. Yeah, and farmers are alone, and they are extremely open to get you in that farm. Initially, and still, we always find certain level of distrust from them. But that's 100% okay. First, we are saying to them that a bunch of young people are going to tell them what to do in their farm, something that they have been doing for 50 years or more sometimes, with satellites, not even installing anything on the farm, just with data. We're going to tell them from the sky what to do next. Yeah. So that promise, when you see it from the point of view of the farmer, and even from the point of view of me initially, it's pretty similar to magic, yeah? So when you're telling that customer you're going to make magic, and that is always tricky, and it needs a level of distrust. And also, agriculture is a risky profession, yeah? So farmers, on average, lose one of each of five crops, yeah? Because you get hail, you get something happens to a crop, you lose one of five, yeah? And you have one crop per year, sometimes two, sometimes, yeah? So you get very few chances at success, and risk is present all the time. So they're very open to get you into the farm, but they're very thorough when evaluating new technology and making changes. And there's a reason for that, and we understand that that's part of the game. Yeah.
So did they have a sense? Okay, so I understand the trust piece because, you know, you're young people, you're coming, you're giving them all, you're showing them all this technology and making promises and. And I don't know, I can't remember who said it, but at some point somebody said, you know, at the most advanced level, AI is indistinguishable from magic, you know, and I think we've all been living through that, especially the last few years. It just feels like magic. And then you start to understand what it is, and then it doesn't feel like magic anymore. And the next thing feels like magic. But, you know, more than that, more than sort of trusting the technology, I also thought, like, as you were speaking, maybe, like, was there any sense that by participating in this project that they would have some kind of collective understanding, you know, that there would be some way to build community among farmers digitally? Like, was that part of the equation at all?
We never factored that in as a fundamental part of our business. We never tried to build a social network of farmers. Yeah, that was not the goal. But it ended up happening. So we built something that's called the Irrigation Academies, where we train farmers. Mm-hmm. We do that online and in person. We have trained 120,000 farmers across Latin America with the academy. At some point, at the hype of the pandemic, when everybody was at home, we used to do one webinar every 2 days, 180 webinars in a year, with 300 farmers from Latin America on each webinar. Yeah, so we understood that one of the key blockers of adoption in AgTech, so adoption in technology for agriculture is really, really low. Yeah, in the U.S., using all with farmers very incentivized and with a lot of support to adopt technology, adoption of irrigation management practices like ours is lower than 10%. Yeah, that was the last USDA survey. So,
what do you attribute that to?
We see there are two main pillars. The first one is education. Yeah, so learning and sharing and because education lowers the risk. Yeah, if you know that your neighbor is doing something that works, that lowers the risk for you. So that's key. That community and education is key. And the second one, and it's the one who has propelled our company or technology, is incentives. What happens with water is that water for agriculture is essentially free. And there is a great reason for that. The reason is that we want food. Yeah, we want to produce food, and we try to keep water, the main resource needed to produce food, as cheap as possible. Yeah. So, but that's in general a terrible incentive to conserve water, right? Why would you conserve something that is free? And everybody is not only giving that resource for you for free, but also provide a strong incentive to produce more. For example, in the US, there are many areas where you have use it or lose it laws. If you don't irrigate all the water you have allocated, you lose it the next year. Yeah, that's a clear incentive to use more water. Yeah, so policy is going against efficiency. Incentives are going against, economic incentives are going against water efficiency. So at some point, we understood we had to break that wheel that was working against us and everybody else in the space. And we managed to find other stakeholders that were ready, sharing the resource, that were very eager to pay for somebody else to be in a good water stewardship. And that's what we did. We connected companies like Microsoft, for example, that have a water positive goal, with farmers that share the resource in watersheds across the globe. And by that, we were able to provide incentives to farmers to be more efficient. And that's what has been doing in the last few years.
So let's switch gears, because I think, you know, it's so important to understand the problem. But let's also talk about, like, you know, what the projects look like. You know, what happens on day one? How do you actually bring this technology to farmers? Obviously, you know, you have satellite, they're starting to get satellite data. Just walk us through what the technology looks like.
So we, on day one with the farmer, we work with them to understand the boundaries of the field, their goals. We have like a small interview with them to understand where and when, how much water they need how much water they have available, how much water they can apply, if they have any restriction in general, because again, agriculture is very unique to every area. Yeah. And then with that, we just draw the field. It's like literally drawing the boundaries of the field. And then our technology start collecting a combination of satellite data and weather data. From satellite data, we combine 5 public satellites that are available for everybody, and 150 private satellites that we buy data from. Yeah. And then for weather stations, we do the same. So we have a crawler that is crawling every publicly available weather station around the world. Yeah, focus, of course, in the areas where we have operations. And then we buy data from some private providers and we combine that data. What we do is something that is, and where we have the bulk of our technology and our knowledge is in doing a lot of machine learning and AI to do sensor fusion. That is mixing different sensors from different types, because we get a weather station from the local government. We got a weather station for a local co-op. Yeah. So those two are different brands with different sensors. So combining the data requires a lot of processing and adjustment and technology. And the same with satellites. Satellite data has a high noise to signal ratio. Yeah, it's very, very noisy. It's getting better and better, but it's still very noisy. So what we do is like build a magic satellite that mixes everything together and provide a very smooth monitoring of what's going on with the crop. With those two data sources, we can know how much water that crop uses on every given day. Yeah. So, and we can do that from the past and do it from yesterday. Yeah. If you know how much water your crop is using, you can know how much water you to apply it. And that's what we do. We provide advice by knowing how much water each crop is using. Yeah.
So you're doing, you know, from what I hear, a vast amount of data preparation in order to be able to kind of send clear signal and clear insights back to the farmers. How did you create a benchmark? Like, how did you figure out, you know, not just what they are using, but what they should be using? And do they opt in their data so that you can, like, how does that work?
No, what we do is, we model a balance of inputs and outputs, yeah? And you always try to, there are clear benchmarks of where you should be in the balance at each part of the cycle. So in the area where you have, for example, you're going maize, in the moment where you have the seed production of the corn, you need to be at 70% water on the water balance, yeah? 70, yeah? So we okay, tried to...
Stupid question for you, Jairo. How do you know it's 70%? Like, where did that come from?
Because we keep a balance. We keep the inputs. Mm. The farmers report us how much water they irrigate. If they have an automated way of reporting that, we gather that. And we have some satellites that can estimate how much irrigation he's applying. Yeah. Mm. We know how much water he's putting there. We know how much water is getting out from the evapotranspiration. That's the technical parameter we measure with satellite weather data. So we know how much you get in, how much is getting out. And by keeping track of those two, you have a balance. You have where you are in the field in that specific moment. And we try to keep the farmer below certain threshold that is preset at the beginning of the season.
And so how do the farmers receive the data? Do they have an app that they use?
They have an app. They have a mobile app that works offline because connectivity is not available everywhere. It's not as harsh as it used to be. Things are changing. You have satellite internet now that works very well. So it's changing, but still.
Yeah.
And then you have a web app they can access with more data. But the key thing here, and thanks for the question, is that we aim to provide beyond charts and analytics, and this happens all the time in AgTech. You have a lot of charts and analytics. We aim to provide them with clear advice. You have to irrigate half an inch next week. Yeah? Because we understood that that was key for the farmer to act. Yeah, they're very busy, and they're also in harsh condition. Most of our farmers are using the app in the middle of the sun, sweaty, maybe with the gloves on because they're driving a tractor or something else. So they are in a condition where analytics don't provide a lot of value, but clear, readable, direct advice of what to do next do provide value for them. So that's what we do. And there we also use GenAI and NLP because we tell them what to do next. You have to irrigate half an inch next week. And that's easy for them to digest. And they also can adjust how that advice comes. Some farmers prefer to understand things in inches. Some farmers prefer to understand in hours. You have to irrigate 2 hours tomorrow. So adjusting that is not that hard from a natural language processing point of view. And that's what we do.
Oh, that's fascinating. We were having a conversation with a gentleman from EY about their neurodiversity programs and working with neurodiverse developers to kind of reduce notification noise because it's so distracting, right? And it's distracting for everybody, but it's particularly distracting for neurodivergent people. And of course, you know, anyone who is in a situation in which focus is critical, in which, the environmental noise around you, and I don't mean like literal noise, but just like the sun, the heat, the sweat, the, you know, just the actual physical activity and the need to kind of keep track of all of these different things happening is so much that like it really ramps down the kinds of notifications that you would want to send. And you must go through some kind of very delicate balance with that.
That's awesome, Susan. Well, something that happened to us by chance is that the first template we used to develop the app was a template with very bright colors. Yeah, that was I can say that it was a brilliant idea from us. It was just by chance, but it worked so well because you're in the sun. You need bright colors.
You need the contrast.
You need a contrast. And that was really good for us, for example. And those small details are come back to what I was saying before, that this exercise on empathy, on understanding the type of customer you're talking to. And something that you also brought up before, and I think that this is interesting in this new age of AI is that there are many common problems, yeah, that are already solved by technology. I don't know, calling buying something and get it delivered to your house, calling a car to go to somewhere else. So that they're like a fixed type of technology work. But what happened with this enormous amount of problems that are extremely different and extremely personalized? And there is a huge opportunity for AI to adjust the interfaces, to adjust how you talk to the user, to adjust how the app works for that user in that specific context. And agriculture is that type of problem. Yeah.
Yeah. It seems like the perfect opportunity. And of course, as the technology develops, maybe that even happens with less involvement from you, right? And or less involvement from them because the signals are coming in and you can think about how they're responding as a way to adjust what that process looks like. I think that's fascinating. So, you know, it kind of brings me to what's next? Like, what do you envision as the next kind of stage of this technology? Where do you think it's going?
We are growing a lot, yeah, because we managed to solve the systemic barrier were incentives. Yeah. So we're expanding. Right now we are operating in 15 watersheds in Latin America and the first one in the US together with Microsoft and other partners in Latin America. And we are seeing a strong traction because more and more companies and governments are starting to understand that if we don't correct how we perceive and treat the value of water, we're getting ourselves in big, big trouble. And this is, of course, exacerbated by the climate crisis that has a huge impact on the water resources, either to severe drought or flood, that is only the other side of the coin for severe drought. Yeah. So yeah. We think that it was a long journey, and it is still a long journey, but we are at the right moment with the right solution, and especially with the right configuration of the solution to move the needle.
Yeah, yeah. As I think you're making your way through that pie chart, right? Where like, if I'm correct here, 70% of fresh water is used for agriculture. Is that right? A little over 70%. And then about 20% for industrial purposes. And I think the remaining is for the rest of us to take our showers and drink our water and live our lives, right?
Yes. And that's also, and world average numbers. Average are always unfair. Yeah. If you take developed countries, it's more like 85%. If you don't find a way to realign incentives in food production, we don't have a chance. Yeah. So it's not only about what Quilimo is doing. It's something that we have to solve. Quilimo is just exploring one vector and has opened a huge vector of opportunity, and many other irrigation providers are moving to the model we develop and discover, and there are many other players that understood that by connecting this industrial water user that can put a bigger value on water because they have a biggest amount of margins and returns, and also a biggest investment on you pay a lot more to set up a data center than to set up a farm. Yeah, so you have a biggest investment there. So this industrial stakeholders that have a much more risk on the line can help this other stakeholder that need better incentives to change the things, the way they are doing things.
So it seems like this model, you know, certainly, you know, as you say, it has application for other areas of agriculture or agriculture in other areas of the world. It has application industrially. You know, I feel like it also, just the model in terms of how you built the trust, how you came to, you know, the empathy first approach to understanding the problem is something that's so applicable to other industries, irrespective of what they make or do or save or care about. And I just wonder, like, you know, as a leader, because how big is Quilimo now? How many people do you have?
We are 70 people or so.
70 people, okay.
35 cities. And towns.
Wow, that's amazing. What a ratio.
Remote. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, you guys are spread thin. Okay, so, but in terms of like, you know, as a leader, like, what have you learned? Because you must have started this, you know, you started this, you've learned a lot. Like, what would you share with others?
I think that we have to, we talk about how technology sometimes is like magic, yeah? Me like a superpower, yes, for something it's a tool that can move the needle. Yeah, what I could share is that I prefer to tackle hard problems. Yeah, I think that we should be very mindful of using the superpower. I mean, not judgment for the fintech, whatever. Yeah, but we must use this superpower and this common people magic that is available to move the needle. Yeah. So and that's our internal definition of success is not about raising money or an exit. Our internal definition of success is this company is going to truly move the needle, yeah, but truly not in a meaningful, measurable, global way. And somehow by just keeping that as the North Stars of every effort we were doing, we got there. We think that we're right now truly moving the needle. And in the areas where we're not moving the needle enough, we're doing the steps that we need to do to be there. So it took us a while. It took us 8 years to get product market fit, only to find the right type of stakeholders engaged together. But if the outcome of that long effort is that you are solving a planetary problem in a scalable way, then 8 years is nothing.
I love that advice or that, you know, passion about, you know, if we have this technology, it's a privilege, right? It's a privilege that we have these powerful technologies that, you know, use that opportunity to solve something meaningful. And, you know, meaning is so, it's so culturally constructed. It's so different, like place to place, area to area. So whatever is meaningful for you, I think that's incredible. And I really appreciate the way that you've approached it because it's such a great example of why it does sometimes take a while for product market fit. And we think about the pace of these technologies moving so, so quickly. But really a lot of the point of this podcast too is to sort of stop and reflect and think about like, what kinds of decisions should we be making? What kinds of questions should we be answering? So thank you so, so much. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you, Susan. I'm very happy for this conversation. It was really great. And I'm looking forward to hearing more about what you guys are doing here at Leading the Ship.
Thank you. Okay, I've had a little time to process the conversation with Jairo, and I keep coming back to this Albert Einstein quote. You've probably heard it. If I had an hour to solve a problem, I would spend the first 55 minutes thinking about the problem and the last 5 minutes thinking of solutions. And I've always thought, okay, sure, you're Albert Einstein. You get to do that. But what about the rest of us? And then I met Jairo. So can you imagine this? Can you imagine getting into a truck and spending 6 months driving over 50,000 kilometers to meet your customers, hear about their needs, and earn their trust? And that's exactly what Kalimo did, even though it can have been either psychologically or physically comfortable, because above all, they believe that product development is an exercise in empathy. And that empathy, plus the superpower of technology, is what they're using to solve one of the world's most consequential problems. And so I hope this conversation with Jairo inspires you, no matter what it is that you're building, to do two things. Combine your superpower with your common people magic to move the needle. Thanks for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. And as I'm sure you know, new podcasts live and die on engagement. So please like, comment, share, tell your friends, and let us know what you'd like to hear about. We're listening. If you'd like to learn more about how people and organizations are innovating with Microsoft Azure, visit azure.microsoft.com. The Leading the Shift podcast is a place for experts to share their insights and opinions. As students of the future of technology, Microsoft values inputs from a diverse set of voices. That said, the opinions and findings of our guests are their own, and they may not necessarily reflect Microsoft's own research or positions. Leading the Shift is a production of Microsoft Azure. I'm your host, Susan Ettlinger. Our executive producers are Haley Meehan, Aaron Russell, Eric Williams, and me. Production support provided by the incredible team at Indigo Slate.